Hello, welcome to podcast episode number 2, Prior Authorizations. And joining me today is Allison Moser, nurse practitioner at Rush University Medical Center in Chicago in the field of hepatology, and she is also a member of GAP, as well as Jeff Dunn, is also joining us again today. Jeff, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Tedra. I am a pharmacist by training, have been in managed care for about 25 years. I've worked at a health plan that was part of an IDN and a couple different PBMs of different models. During that course of time, have had responsibilities for formulary, rebates, pricing, clinical programs, et cetera.
Thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to have this conversation today.
Thank you, Tedra. So maybe I can start with a question for the two of you, if that's okay.
Sure.
So the first question is, what proactive steps have you taken to reduce the risk of PA denials?
The proactive steps that I've taken to reduce PA denials has really started with documentation, ensuring that in that moment in the room where I'm doing that history and physical exam, that I'm asking the appropriate questions and then documenting appropriately medications that have been tried, the length of time, and the effects and outcomes. Also ensuring that I'm using the appropriate ICD-9 codes when identifying a disease state or diagnosis that will be required for the medication to be approved, and then expeditiously working on the PA when it comes across my office to ensure that I am addressing any and all questions and concerns appropriately.
I agree with Tedra. I do a similar practice. I also try to stay up to date on the specific requirements of the insurers that we tend to work most frequently with. We also make sure that we're thoroughly reviewing prior authorizations before submission, making sure they have all the appropriate documentation and clinical rationale. We do train our staff regularly on coding and documentation best practices, as this has been instrumental in helping lead to minimizing errors that could potentially lead to denials.
Great. Thank you both. This is a related question, but maybe worded in a slightly different way. And it is, how do you ensure that your PA submissions are successful on the first attempt?
I would agree with Allison. I think in addition to doing all of the steps that we had mentioned before, having another set of eyes on the PA would be my attempt at ensuring that the submission on the first attempt is successful. So not only myself, but also our pharmacy liaisons within the specialty pharmacy, just to ensure that we are up to date with the requirements, that there isn't a question that was overlooked or that was that could use a little bit more in-depth explanation, and also ensuring that, again, the diagnosis codes are appropriate, the dose and the SIG for the medication is appropriate. So just having that extra set of eyes is supremely helpful in ensuring that the submission is successful in the first attempt.
I've also leveraged electronic prior authorization tools when available, as this has helped improve our first attempt success rates by automating much of the process and reducing the likelihood of missing critical information. I also use feedback from prior submissions in order to kind of refine my approach as needed.
Great, thank you. So you mentioned EPA tools and other things. What other tools like PA templates or benefit verification to streamline the process are you implementing in your practices?
I really use the templates that are through some of the electronic PA process platforms like CoverMyMeds, where they populate the criteria questions based upon the drug, and then some benefit verifications when running like a test claim to ensure that we're getting the ability to see a true rejection message versus various reasons that could be given to us, like it's a non-formulary drug or quantity limit or just a regular prior authorization is needed. So running a test claim is very important, and it helps to inform us if the patient needs to use a different pharmacy other than what we have within our hospital institution, as well as whatever their insurance may require.
I definitely agree. I think benefit verification is another crucial step. We make sure that we verify the patient's coverage and benefits early in the process, ideally at their first visit, allowing us to identify any potential issues or requirements before submitting the PA. And having this proactive approach that both Tedra and I are mentioning helps reduce delays as well as rejections.
So you've brought up some interesting issues. Last question for you, and I'll explain this and dive into it a little bit, is as you mentioned, there's maybe a disconnect sometimes between information under the pharmacy benefit, information under the medical benefit. Sometimes prior authorizations require genetic testing or labs or other things, which can create issues when you're submitting. So how do you approach tying all this together and finding all of the information to make a complete prior authorization request?
I would say it's a constant process. It's a process of continuous education, familiarizing yourself with current evidence-based practice, and familiarizing yourself with the current requirements of a payer. It's a delicate balance. It's a dance that is never perfected, but it's constantly in a state of improvement over your practice time as a clinician.
Yeah, I think getting a general sense of insurers' clinical guidelines and documenting exam findings in a way that clearly supports medical necessity of the proposed treatment is critical. What we've kind of talked about before, using precise language, relevant diagnostic codes, referencing evidence-based guidelines in your note. When you do this, you know, your documentation directly correlates with the coverage requirements, so that can minimize discrepancies.
Great. Thank you, Allison. Tedra?
No problem. Great, Jeff. I have some questions for you as well. What are some of the common reasons prior authorizations get denied? And how can we as advanced practice providers better prepare our submissions?
Yeah, good question. I don't know if this is going to surprise either one of you, but the number one reason for a denial is lack of information. And you both kind of talked about that, is incomplete submission forms or missing data, something like that. So it's operational. It's not even clinical. I would say the second most common reason is the lack of a trial of more cost-effective or preferred regimens or medications. And maybe even the patients tried them, but they're not documented. A lot of times we'll go back and look through pharmacy claims history in addition to just looking at the prior authorization, but sometimes that information's not there. An example would be, if you look at the guidelines for diabetes, it suggests or recommends that metformin is used before you move on to more expensive medications. And so we require that in our step therapy or prior authorizations for a lot of the diabetes drugs. And it's evidence-based, it's guideline supported, but a lot of times we can't find metformin in a history and a physician is jumping straight to the branded medication. That may be appropriate. And that's part of the reason, you know, why we do a prior authorization is it's never going to be a one size fits all for everybody. And there's a process. But the challenge is, you know, these are population tools and we can't have, you know, 5,000 different forms of a PA. That would even frustrate you more than you're already frustrated, I would imagine. So we have to start somewhere. And we try to practice, again, evidence-based medication. And we try to start with more cost-effective medications moving, you know, first before we move on to others. But I would say those are the two most common. You know, having said that, how can we better prepare or how can you better prepare submissions? State the obvious is be as complete as possible, explain the rationale, and if there's deviations for step therapies and other things, explain that. Be very explicit on author's contraindications or they've had prior adverse events or something like that. I think end of the day, we want to find the right drug for the right patient. And we don't want to start with a no, but we need the evidence. We need the evidence to make a decision because we have to defend that decision down the road with our clients who are paying for these medications. I will just say the last minor comment is we also don't like form letters. So as much as you know, a lot of these are form letters and we can start there, but if you're trying to make an exception to what's on the PA form, then we do need a rationale and a clear explanation for why we're deviating from the pre-specified requirements.
Oh, thank you so much for that robust answer and very detailed. I appreciate your insight. A follow-up question I have is, how can payers and APPs work together to expedite the PA process and reduce the burden on the patient?
Yeah, and I think this is a hard one because it's kind of high level answers. It's hard to say really if you can do X, Y, and Z, things are going to get better. But it really comes down to communication. And if things change, if there's new data, new guidelines, et cetera, even though we see it and we try to be up to speed, keep us informed, let us know, reach out. But as much as possible, if you can have relationships or develop relationships with your largest payers in your area, that goes a long way. And because of that, if we've seen providers who are really diligent in following the guidelines and doing what they're supposed to be doing, and when we get requests to deviate, that it's well documented, you know, we've done things like gold carding, and there's other things that we can do to make life easier. But again, we have to have that history there, and we have to have that trust level, and we have to have evidence that really the providers are doing everything in their best interest to start with and follow the, you know, the cost-effective practice of medicine before we move on to other things. My hope is, and I think Allison, you may have mentioned this. Our hope is that technology and AI will make this easier for all of us. But it really requires, you know, access to the medical records and the EMRs and everything else. But if we can tie this all together and make it more automated, I think that's pretty exciting. We have to have standards and guidelines around that. I think that's where we're struggling a little bit. But there's hope that this will get better as technology advances. But end of the day, it really comes down to that level of trust and the communication between the provider and the payer.
Thank you so much. I love that answer. Very detailed. And this concludes our part two of our podcast. Thank you, Allison and Jeff, for your participation. And thank you for listening to part two of this three-part series of APP strategies for prior authorization and evolving distribution. If you haven't tuned in to episode one, please feel free to access it in our GAP Digital Hub and tune in to part three for another invigorating conversation.